pictures the vibration of the trash bags, which made it a very sensitive, supple, refined wood. Little by little, the wood had grown. The wood was not alive then, it was merely the body of wood, but its vibration was constantly being refined. And so it is with matter. All matter is gradually transforming itself into etheric units. And ultimately, this matter that we know around us will disappear. And in its place, there will be an entirely more subtle state of matter. But don't worry about it. It won't happen at the time that you are owning real estate. I am reasonably certain. It'll be terrible to think of one of your best frontages slowly vanishing. But I might point out that that can also be done by means of taxation. So it's not necessary for you to worry about any disaster at the moment. But in the course of millions of years, matter will gradually reduce itself to etheric units and be much more responsive and much more subtle than it is now. And because other more ancient cycles of matter have passed into this state already, we have this mysterious, subtle, or etheric quality, which has been called anciently the body of the gods, because beings of higher orders of life are said to be vested in this type of material. So bodies are evolving under our guidance. They are suffering under our abuses. But the gradual motion is that man is growing, that man is learning, unfolding. And just as every year he makes some real and some artificial improvements on his automobile, so nature is eternally refining its product and making it more useful for the purposes for which it was intended. And man, working with matter, is gradually becoming a master sculptor until, like in the story of Pygmalion and Galatea, ultimately the statue itself will come to life. So we have a little picture of the broad concept of Indian anthropology as it relates to the story of the human body. Now we have to take up another important subject, and that is the relations that we have found so prominent down through the ages of the growth of spiritual values through various flagellations and privations of the flesh. In other words, this instinctive tendency of the human being to turn from body, to consider body as something profane, and to consider its various activities as unworthy of his spiritual destiny. This, of course, would be the perfectly natural reaction of the individual in his automobile if you asked him if his car was himself. He would be highly insulted. He would certainly feel that you should realize that he is more intelligent than his car, or he wouldn't be able to drive it. On the other hand, the car is not something which in itself is evil. It is the use that is made of it, or the abuse, which determines whether it is a thing of help or a thing of hindrance. And the general attitude, particularly of the medieval man of Europe toward body, was certainly a prejudiced one, one that did not take into consideration the value of body in his life. And I think we must take the same attitude in a little broader way in estimating and evaluating what we call material civilization. Material civilization has something of the quality of a collective body. We would all like to get away from it. We would all like to live in an ideal world where there are no more unreasonable politicians and no more exploitations. We kind of review or regard the material world as a place of trouble. And we are inclined to think of the physical body as something about which we might be slightly ashamed. Actually, the Greeks were much wiser in their estimation of these values. Well, they recognized that the physical body, when it was understood and used properly as it should be, was a magnificent instrument about which no individual should have fear or negation, but should recognize it as having been bestowed upon him by an all-wise providence who certainly did not give him something he did not need. The conflict, therefore, again arises between man-made attitudes and nature. And the individual who holds beliefs which are contrary to nature must ultimately suffer. And the belief that the body is some kind of a limitation or hindrance will assume naturally that nature or God, in their wisdom, has bestowed upon man that which is unnecessary, unreasonable, or unworthy. Such cannot be the case. Therefore, that man possesses body that man is limited by body to, in some ways at least, and is responsible for the maintenance of this form, this must essentially all conspire together for good. Otherwise it would not exist. In the great systems of ancient teaching, therefore, the tendency was not to take the attitude with which we are somewhat familiar. The Buddhist doctrine, for example, of renunciation, which was a departure from worldliness, has been symbolically misinterpreted. The would-be holy man has departed from life and all of its responsibilities and retired to a cave on the side of a hill where he lives unbathed and unkempt for the next 50 years. This is not the spirit of the philosophy, however. It is not the purpose of it. Because it is not man's departure from the world that is important. It is the recognition within the being itself that it has a dimension beyond the world that is important. It is not man in the world, but the world in man that must be changed. It is the human attitude toward things which leads to abuse and misuse that is at fault. It is the being itself that has misunderstood the world and misunderstood life, and then penalizes the body for its own mistake. Actually, the beginning of true spirituality is a close harmony between the being and the body. And this close harmony is finally expressed through the willingness of the being to assist the body to the perfection of its own duty and purpose. Remember that it is the being that most always pollutes the body. And for once, when the body does an ill turn to being, there are 100 cases where a being has done an ill turn to the body. It is not the body that runs to excess. It is not the body that seeks all kinds of false gratifications. These things we blame upon the body, but the blame lies within the psychological organism of the human being himself. Consequently, the ancients were very clear in pointing out that the gradual learning of how to normalize the functions of body, this learning carried with it the key to man's internal integration. For that which happens on one level physically happens on another level metaphysically. And the same laws and principles are operating in both cases. Let us say, for example, to use one of the yogic ideas, that an individual wishes to control selfishness. Now, selfishness is a kind of a strange, ethereal, undimensioned thing that when you think you have it, slips through your fingers. And selfishness, when you try to work with it, is so attenuated that the very most unselfish thing you try to do may be your supreme monument to selfishness. You're never sure. You're never sure when you do that good deed, whether it's because you want to help someone or because it pleases you. You never know whose satisfaction is first. Selfishness is a very, very hard thing off in space to work with. And you can so easily talk yourself into saying that you are unselfish and that everybody else is selfish. I know people who say they're the most unselfish beings in the world, but those around them always want to do what they want to do, when this unselfish person really wants them to do what he wants them to do. You can rationalize almost anything. And you can come to the most amazing, conflicting opinions about which no two persons will agree. And yet, it is very difficult to maintain a dynamic disagreement about a stomachache. When it hurts, and there is no doubt about it. Also, when you want to correct something, you know when you've corrected it, because when the body problem has been solved, the body says so. No doubt about it. You can't close your eyes and say, I have no stomachache, and then open them again, because it's still there. You can use all kinds of pain-killing drugs, but the stomachache will remain until the cause is removed. Can't fool the body. It is a strange and wonderful teacher. And it is because it is relentless in its resolution that you shall be instructed. But we have a tendency to like to escape the whole idea and work it out somewhere else. So when you want to exercise self-discipline, there's no place where it is a more tangible instrument and the results of your attainment are more immediately visible than right in the physical body. If you want to know what your self-control is, there's no quicker way of finding out than with the physical body. And if you do not have that self-control and must build it, there is no easier or more certain method of finding out how and to what degree you must develop it and how it can be strengthened and matured than when you are working with a simple physical problem that you can see all the values of and which will remain unsolved until it is solved. There are no emotional escapes. There are no rationalizing of black into white. The physical body, there must be the answer, or there is no answer. It is a rugged disciplinarian. But when you have put it in order, you have achieved a tremendous thing. And immediately, you discover that you have the strength to proceed and to continue with achievement upon other levels. The great proof of strength is its sufficiency under actual test conditions. And the body is a perpetual test condition about which there can be no subterfuge or deceit. Thus, if you really are interested in the yogic disciplines, try the simple disciplines that they begin with. The disciplines, for instance, of being able to relax the body. And you will find out that it has attached to it a whole series of conclusions and consequences that you have to do something about. We have people coming in frequently who bring in their problems, and they insist that their only real difficulty is the fact that they have a very unpleasant twitch. Whenever they walk down the street and start talking with their friends, they go this way. There's nothing the matter with them except this little nervous condition. So you start with this minor affliction, and you keep on tracing it. And before you get through with it, you find out everything that is wrong with their spirit, souls, minds, and bodies before you can get at the cause of that twitch. And you also have the wonderful realization that until that situation is cured, the twitch won't stop. Oh, it is quite possible that by hypnosis you can take it away. 6 months later, the individual will go this way instead. The symptoms may change, but they will never disappear until the condition is cured. And no substitutes will be accepted. No half answers. No compromises. Either it is solved or it is not solved, and there can be no doubt. This type of thinking is very good for those who are really interested in building a strong philosophy of life, because it gives them this wonderful instrument for checking themselves, for making sure that what they believe they are accomplishing. Now, on the emotional level, the control of appetites, the physical appetites, will indicate very clearly the control of emotional appetites and the control of mental habits. The individual can't control the physical part, will never control the metaphysical part. The answer is, of course, something we hate to believe, namely that the physical is actually the easiest part to control. And the individual who is able to recognize this realizes that he graduates from a less difficult to a more difficult task. And if he does not bring with him some equipment, if he has not made some achievement, if he has not learned to use the interior faculties which he possesses, in a moderate way at least, he certainly cannot suddenly summon them to his assistance in a spiritual emergency. So the body starts him off. By the very simple processes of growth, being takes possession of body. But being is never really master of body until it sets itself this goal, that it shall make out of this body, as nearly as possible, a perfect instrument for the manifestation of its purpose. The immature, inadequate body fails the being on the level of objective function. And you'll be surprised to what degree bodily infirmities can interfere with the rational integration of the being. This does not mean that the being is actually sick, but it means that the manifestation of the being is not complete. And more difficult still, that the testimonies of the body by which the being should be informed are not accurate. The moment the body, because of lack of proper function, because of obstruction, becomes toxic, the entire relationship between the being and the body is sickened. The moment toxin comes in, man cannot trust his eyes, his ears, or any other sensory faculty. He cannot trust his emotions, and he cannot trust his thoughts. Because the toxic condition, as the term implies, carries with it a situation or condition which damages the communication lines between the being and the body. A great deal, therefore, of what we might term emotional pessimism may arise from high toxic rate. And the individual is physically uncomfortable, is not in the best condition to learn, to grow, to live, to love, or to work. Thus the body penalizes us for intemperance of all or any kind. And because the average American citizen does not have freedom from toxin, and because toxin may originate either from neglect of body or from tension afflicting body, the average citizen's opinions and attitudes are not sufficient. He is not adequate as a citizen. He is not adequate as a voter. He is not adequate as a businessman or as a family man, simply because the relation between being and body are not healthy. The relations are not normal or reasonable. So he goes along and he makes a whole series of bad decisions. He is too nervous. He is too upset. He loses his temper too easily. And the first thing you know, he loses his job. And out of these tragedies and disasters, he develops negative attitudes. He becomes abused. He becomes fearful. He becomes persecuted. And in time, completely, mentally, and emotionally sick. Because he did not keep these communication lines open. The Chinese say, and they are very well known for their wisdom on many points, that all human beings begin to die in the intestines. And this means the greatest area of toxic build. And it is also in this area that you get the greatest obstruction of energy fields. And therefore, that is why the trouble generally starts in that area. So the person who wishes to grow, wishes to know, wishes to become a sufficient human being, has this basic and certain responsibility to the vehicle that has been given to him. And with this responsibility in mind, he must recognize the need for maximum function in every way possible. He must experiment sometimes with himself, because there is no common rule in these things. One man's meat is often his brother's poison. But each must find the levels and the planes upon which his own function is most complete, in which there is the least abuse of natural laws in the achievement of purposes which we have set in motion. When we find these levels of action, we then maintain a close harmony between being and body. Now, body gives man another instrument which he has to think about a great deal, and that is this hand with the five fingers, or the four fingers and the thumb, which we mentioned to you. Now, because he has this, he can hold a hammer or a monkey wrench, and also he can hold a delicate scientific instrument or a pen and write a book or a sword and win a battle. Actually, the hand is that part of the body by which man releases certain archetypes. And in ancient religious symbolism, the hand of God was always the symbol of the expressing power of God. And the hand of God in man is represented by the human hand, which is the expressing power of the human being. There is a direct communication between the brain and the hand. Perhaps this is most obvious in something like a brilliant musician, but it is present everywhere. Because through the hand, man transforms the natural world into a laboratory. By that I mean that man, by means of the hand, takes over the governing of the material world of which he is a part. It is the hand which enables him to make things, to build a house, to draw a picture. It is the hand by means of which ideas locked within his own soul can be brought forth and given symbolic embodiments through the things that he does. Now, through thousands of years of trial and error experimentation, man has discovered that the eternal law that is in him and in space is perhaps most manifested through the things that he makes with his hands. The individual doesn't realize when he nails a box together or makes a chair that in so doing he is calling upon dozens of unfamiliar principles of dynamics, of structure, of stress and strain, and many other things. He is instinctively geometrizing when he makes things. And he puts all these different contrivances together, and in the beginning perhaps he did not put quite the correct number of legs on the chair. As a result of that, the chair did not serve him very well. But before he got through, he found that the least number of legs that would make a successful stool, the least number was three. And he hit upon a truth that was bigger than time. He hit upon a truth that extends all the way from the three legs of the stool to the three persons of the Holy Trinity. He discovered that three was strangely a foundation. He also discovered that the least number of surfaces with which he could enclose an object or an area was four. He discovered also how he could put and combine things together. First, he built for utility alone. He didn't care what the stool looked like. There are people like that today who seem to be perfectly happy to make chairs out of soap boxes. And they don't know the difference, or do not seem to. But gradually, man passed from utility to gentility. He passed from making things just because he needed them, and he began to make them beautiful because they pleased him better that way. So out of his hands came also aesthetics, or the beautifying of things. He also found that he could weed a garden with his hands, and in that way he could help the flowers to grow and to make certain things that he wanted more beautiful. And little by little, through objective use of his hands alone, he created the tools that would sometime take the place of his hands, for he fashioned them. But like the car, they are no use unless he holds them. So by degrees, the tools became better, simply because the ideas of man grew more rapidly than his hands. And it might take him a million years to evolve a natural cold chisel, so it seemed easier to make one. But all these things which seem to us so trite, so commonplace, and so inevitable, each is a miracle. Each is a wonder in itself, which if we were thoughtful, would tell us something of the mystery of universal life and God and spirit in the universe. But we have, at the time, passed over these things. We take them all for granted, as we take the material body which we have for granted. And one of the most wonderful ways to remain ignorant is to take things for granted, because by so doing you miss the law. You do not fulfill the requisite set by the Zen priest, who says that in everything that you do, you must find the law. For learning is forever discovering the law. And everything you do, therefore, with your hands, reveals by its propriety or impropriety your knowledge or ignorance of the law. And the most intricate patent that was ever granted was granted only to a person who found a little more complete way of putting the law in motion, or putting the law into formal activity. So everything we do with the hands, everything that our thoughts lead us to transform into action, all this symbolism has to do with the body, with the world, with matter, and with physical things. And the individual who learns to sculpt or form will sometime be able to mold life. We are here to use, to learn, to grow, and to perfect our understanding of this mystery which we call personal body and universal body. Now, recognizing this world as a laboratory, and realizing that we are in it, and being in it, that we are constantly mingling with other bodies, we come into this amazing realization that we live in a world of forms, each form with some kind of a purpose behind it that we do not comprehend, and that our entire relationship with life, as we know it, is merely a relationship of forms. That races and nations and tribes and clans are simply groups of forms, and that their psychologies are a compounding glimpse of something that lies behind collective form patterns. Also, around us everywhere in the world, there are problems of adjustment. Problems of adjusting other persons' patterns to our own. One of these points means that everywhere around us are men in cars, and that we must adjust ourselves while we drive our car to all the other people who are in cars. And as you know from traffic, that's a tricky situation and will sometimes be almost more than we can accomplish. We know what happens in traffic if one person makes a foolish mistake, how it may result in many cars being involved in a terrible compound accident. Almost right there. And so, in life, we have relationships. And relationships in the home, or in the business, in the factory, in the store, in the club, all these relationships are the meetings, minglings, gatherings, and separatings of forms. We are also aware, however, that each of these forms has a life in it, and that part of these relationships must be the reconciling of the life in us to the life in these other forms. But if the form wasn't there, we wouldn't recognize the relationship or the life. And so we have another laboratory, the laboratory of relationships. Form gives us relationships. Form tells us that one individual is a Frenchman, another a German, a third an Italian. Now this has nothing to do with what is inside of them, except the fact that the inside is usually psychologically related to the folk or the collective race group to which the individual belongs, related to it by evolutionary process. But now we have these nations, and we have the great political theater in which they can't get together. We also have innumerable problems arising on the form level. And yet these forms are comparatively limited. There's only about 2.5 billion of them on Earth. These forms also group into patterns, of which there are perhaps 300 or 350 patterns. We have never been able yet to get these patterns together by United Nations, or by Hague conferences, or by the League of Nations. Yet here we have forms, each of them with geometrical psychological formulas. And here we have to work them out. So on the form world level also, we must solve relationships. We must solve a biological relationship, father and son, mother and daughter. We must solve psychological or theological relationships, husband and wife. We must solve economic relationships, management and labor. We must also solve the great political relationships, the state and the people. We must even go so far as to solve the great bugaboo of all times, the state and the church. These things have to be solved. Here, physically, we can move these chest people around. Here we can see the result of a poor solution. Here we can see what it means when selfishly we distort facts for our own convenience. Every mistake that we make materially and physically, we can see. If we cannot see the actual move, we can see the consequences. There can be no doubt. And that's why this dear old world is so highly educational. Here is something that is apparent, obvious, undeniable. We learn in the grand, long picture of it all that to obey is to live and to disobey is to die. That there are no recourses, whatever. And that the only answer that the individual can ever find to his problem is to outgrow his own ignorance. We cannot say that the material world is useless if it makes him learn these lessons. We cannot say the material world is useless if it helps a brother and sister to learn that they have to share their toys. It does not fail. It has meaning as long as it teaches us that husband and wife must leave all else and cling to each other. These laws, which have been in operation from time immemorial, tell us things that we all need to learn. And they are the laws upon which we later build into the study of man's higher nature. Because this is the visible seal of all that we do not see. And anything that is solved here forms a foundation to ascend. And anything that is unsolved here will never be solved in any other sphere. That is why the ancient Hindus insisted that there was no evolution between births. That man's growth has to be accomplished in the material world. Here he must make his decisions. Here he must abide by them. Because here and here alone, he cannot influence the results of his own actions. Nor can he close his mind and close his eyes to the hurts and pains that he sees every day. He cannot ignore material things. Here also his standard of values must be mastered. Here he must determine what is valuable. And he can only do so by the slow and difficult trial and error method of putting his faith and his hope on false values and seeing them destroyed. I know a good many persons who have put their hopes on invisible false values. These people have been successfully deluded for a lifetime because they could never actually see their mistake. But if you invest in the wrong stock here, you're not left very much doubt very long. And if your decisions are essentially poor, you will live to see the results. Also, you will see the results of collective mistakes, bad policies, bad laws. You see what happens when we disregard principles. There is no place in the universe where ignorance is more obvious than here. And there is no place where wisdom is more necessary. So out of all this material thing we call the body, we are given the blessed and wonderful privilege of these contacts. We are given the chance to go to school and to learn the first lessons of our own godhood. We are now able to begin to think in terms of the importance of the three R's, including reading, which is now a little neglected. But we also learn how to learn. We skill the tools that we must use. And the individual who is not willing to learn how to use the chisel will never be a great sculptor later. It's the long patience, the struggle, the striving, the disappointments, the tragedies. It is the gradual strengthening of character against adversity. And the gradual recognition of principles and their superiority to personal equations. These things prepare us. Prepare us for philosophies. So philosophies, even those of the greatest, are born out of man's earthly need, out of his earthy experience, striving to know. And had it not been for matter, there could have been no Plato, no Buddha, and no Jesus. These things have to be part of man's plan. We could not recognize the solution unless we had the problem. So material things are merely the toys and blocks of infant gods with which they build, which they can assemble, cast down, and reassemble, until the forms they fashion meet their pleasure and their need. And each one of us is playing with these cosmic toys as Dionysus played with the toys of Zeus. And from this playing, whether it be awkward or skillful, we are gradually learning to understand, learning to know and to grow. And through our sensory perceptions, these observations are taken into our internal lives. Now there's one catch in it, however. And that is that in this playing and growing and learning and all these activities, the individual is very apt to become a little unbalanced. He is apt to believe that he is merely learning these things in order that he may be successful here and now. That is a mistake. He is not learning simply in order that he can keep on doing the things he is learning forever. That would not be growth. If you study the works of a great painter, you will see that in his various years he passes from one style to another, until finally he matures that for which he becomes distinguished. In the same way, the individual, passing through the various periods of living and their experiences, is presumed and supposed to build a philosophy of life based upon observation and reflection, a philosophy suitable to maintain him as a being, as a person in a body. To forget the purpose of life is to be what I would term a materialist. A materialist is not an individual who simply lives here, but an individual who does not realize that he can live anywhere else. A materialist is one who has taken the means for the end, and who believes, for example, that in the conquest of interstellar space, he is fulfilling all the dreams of humanity from the first amoeba up to now. Also, the individual who perhaps believes that if he can be on the first space station, he will establish a precedent that his descendants will remember forever. These limitations destroy the value of schooling. No school child would take the attitude that he's going to school in order to learn how to stay there forever. Nor would he want medical science to find a panacea by which he could remain in the sixth grade for 500 years. What he has forgotten is that he is learning in order that by learning he may fit himself for a constantly enlarging existence. It is his failure to accept that that is his materialism. It is not that he is here that makes him a materialist. It is that he loses interest in being anywhere else, and becomes completely satisfied or certain that he has no existence except that of the material schoolroom in which he finds himself. If he takes this attitude, then he closes his mind to such forms of experience as might prepare him for a universal destiny that lies beyond. Fortunately, he can do nothing about it, really. The most he can do is temporarily delay himself. He cannot change his destiny because he has to grow. But he can make growth painful for himself and others if he wants to. If, however, he accepts growth and realizes that materialism is the beginning, is the dark earth in which the seed of immortality is sown, and that without this dark earth below, the magnificent lotus cannot ultimately blossom on the surface of the lake. If he realizes that from materialism, as he calls it, which is the great Mother Earth of growth, all seeds grow. Their crime is not that they are in the earth, but their crime would be that they do not come out of it. But because of life and light, all good seeds will come out and follow the ancient and inevitable law of growth, which is natural to their kind. So materialism is the individual voluntarily rejecting a larger life and limiting himself and his interests totally to physical concerns. If he does this, he can block his growth for the period of a lifetime. But with the inevitable disintegration of his body, he cannot continue to be a materialist indefinitely. He is protected against these fixations by the law of life and death. And if by some chance his mental fixation is so great that, as the Buddhist doctrine points out, that he can continue to be reborn a materialist for 10, 20, or 50 lives, he will ultimately lose and the universe will win. All he can do is sometime regret that he was so hard to instruct. So materialism, to a degree, is constantly being battled by the very forces of the material world itself. From the beginning, man has sensed that while he is studying in this amazing classroom by means of this astonishing body which he possesses, that this classroom and this body, these two do not constitute his total existence. That these do not have all the answers, nor all the wisdom, nor all the skill. And that there is something else, superior and beyond, which materialism itself gradually reveals. So that ultimately, if any human being studies matter with sufficient earnestness and sufficient continuity of effort, he will ultimately become an idealist. He can't help it. Because matter itself leads inevitably to its own root and source, where it mingles with the streams of eternal life. The human being cannot escape this. He cannot be a devout scientist without ultimately becoming a mystic. But it may take him several lives to pass through this intricate mechanism by means of which he will come to this attainment. But if he is honest, not one moment of it will have been lost, because in each level he will have gained that which he can use later. It is only if he is false to his own principles that he brings upon himself the penalty of wasted effort. So the body gives us all these opportunities. And on one level, therefore, the body is the teacher. For the body is, strangely enough, the first yogin with which each of us must labor. The body is like some old ancient Hindu holy man sitting quietly on a rock out in the forest or on the edge of some hilly plain. He doesn't speak, he simply sits there. You wonder about him, you wish he would speak, you wonder if he knows you're there. There's something inscrutable and wonderful about him. Perhaps, ultimately, he will become his disciple. And if you do become his disciple, the first thing he will demand of you is utter obedience. You will do what he says. You will obey him. Now, this might sound like he was a very arrogant individual, especially in a good democratic commonwealth like ours, but he is only a symbol. This old gentleman doesn't care whether anyone obeys him or not, because he's no longer interested in these things. But he knows that he can never help you unless he can first of all make you recognize the necessity for discipline. Unless you learn to obey him, you will never be able to obey the gods. Unless you have learned first the simple lessons of sincere doing, you will never go on to the great teachings that lie beyond. And this is the way in which the great mother of mysteries, the black Isis, the great symbol of nature herself, operates. And the great temple of the Isis of Sais in Egypt, where the mother of mysteries rules supreme, represented the temple of the material universe, ruled over by the great power of nature, who is man's first and primordial teacher, his eternal nurse, as long as he lives in this world. And those who would go on to the higher mysteries of life must first of all graduate from the school of nature. And they graduate from this school by recognizing the necessity of conquering nature around them and human nature within them. They do this symbolically by putting the body in order. And in this action, they prove their devotion. Therefore, the mudra becomes also not only a seal but a statement of allegiance. When the individual sufficiently desires truth, that he will control his own life and body in order that he may justify and merit truth, when he is that sincere, he will grow. Until such time as that, he must advance and progress more slowly by the circuitous path of natural evolution itself. The only way the individual can break the rhythm of evolution and grow more rapidly than his world is to control himself more rapidly than others do. And the beginning of this self-control is symbolically the gradual integration of his faculties and his powers. And his willingness, for instance, to accept as an act of worship the soul maturing, developing, normalizing his body, that the life within it can shine through and accomplish its purposes. If man, therefore, is not willing to build his temple according to the law, the living God will not dwell therein. And before man was able to have the great religious worship that we know, he first built his altar in the wilderness. He built his tabernacle and his temple, his shrine, his mosque, his synagogue. And each of these buildings dedicated to the service of God are physical things, but the God that dwells in them is not. And each of these buildings, perfected by the workmen who gave and concentrated and contributed their costs and causes to this work, these buildings symbolize the integrated human body, the body which is put in order, the body which is transformed from a place of merchandising to a house of the eternal wisdom. So each person makes his statement of faith, makes his declaration of belief, not by words, but by so making his own life orderly and consistent, that it bears witness to his sincerity and devotion of purpose. He can claim anything, but his body cannot be deceived. He can pretend anything, but unless he proves in action that he possesses these abilities of self-control and integration, he cannot deceive anyone but himself. And so the body serves its wonderful and unique purposes. And through it, all the other principles are released into our way of life. And through it also, and by growth, man gains those more subtle experiences. Because just as surely as the physical body of man binds him to the physical universe, so there are other levels of the universe to which he is associated by other bodies. And as he unfolds these sequentially and systematically, as he grows within, the universal mystery unfolds around him. For he can see only and understand only according to the instruments that he has built. And if he is dark, the universe is dark. But if he is light within himself, then the universe is enlightened throughout all its parts. Not because it has changed, but because man has then the faculties and perceptions by which he can examine into the greater mysteries of life. So the physical body, we feel, has been slighted, and the physical part it plays in the growth of man as a spiritual being should be more familiar and better understood by all students who wish to grow in nature's way, which after all is the great way of the spirit, just as surely as it is the great way of philosophy. So next week we will take the next act of this drama, which will be the second of man's bodies, and we will consider more and more the effect of the superphysical vehicles upon the body. But we wanted to sort of orient with the body itself first. Now I'd like to...